The Flatus Show is recorded in front of a live studio audience. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Melly the Cockatiel. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Cider. Not for my diet, but just to drink. Angry Orchard apple ginger cider. I mean, what other kinds of cider are there, right? Delicious, kids. How you doing? I'm your host, Kenty. And with me in the studio is Melly the Cockatiel, welcoming you to another wonderful week of the Flatus Show. That was an okay burp. So, I have been busy today. Let's see. Yesterday was Saturday, and Johnny and I had to go and buy a new washer and dryer. And we took our Love Bowl money and bought a Blu-ray player to accompany the new TV. And I bought for Johnny Finding Nemo in 3D, which is really fun to watch in 3D. And it's a fun movie. And then I also bought Jaws on Blu-ray. And it is incredible, the clarity of the picture. It's almost like... I'm trying to, and let me just say this, is that even the DVD, older DVDs come out super, super clear. I watched Waterworld, the beginning of Waterworld. I like that movie. It's so hokey. It's, I don't know why. I like it. I like it like I like Showgirls. And Waterworld was really clear too. It's like, I don't know how to describe it, but... When I used to see a movie, there's a certain quality to the image. I mean, even in the movie theaters. But on this HD TV, it's almost like videotape, you know? And it's a little disconcerting because it's a little too realistic looking, I guess. You know, you can tell when you're in a sound stage and when you're you can tell it's not as seamless, you know. I think there is a quality to film which is really missing from HD, you know. It's almost like what I remember people complaining about CDs, like digital music was just too perfect. And I understand that. This is like the images are too, like, clear, you know? Is it possible to be too clear? Perhaps, you know? Especially if you're not used to it. But, of course, you know, there's going to be whole generations of people growing up with Blu-ray and HD TV, which is going to look extremely clear. I mean, I can see... in the future where it's all 3D, right? And it's going to look like the places are going to be exactly where are recorded, exactly where they're recorded. It's going to look, they're going to have to be more careful when they are transferring, when they're making movies, because right now, like if I like watching Waterworld, right, I can tell the changes I'm more aware of it. I'm more aware of how the film was made watching it on Blu-ray than I was before, where I could just go into the story but there's something about the high definition which takes away for me just sitting there relaxing and enjoying the movie. Though I do like the big screen. Cider. So, kids, how have you been doing? I've been doing good. Today, I said on Facebook the other day, I said, I'm going to make some mead. So I spoke to Rand, my friend, heathen friend, the man who introduced me to heathenry, and he makes mead. And his mead is quite delicious, which I've mentioned in previous podcasts. So I thought, I'm going to make some mead. What made me think about this is that it's old-fashioned. I mean, it's, you know, it's right on my ass, basically, you know, with my 19th century cooking. I found a 19th century recipe for a Jewish Passover wine called raisin wine, which is basically just water and raisins, a lemon, and that's it. You know, not even yeast. And you let it sit for a week, strain it, and then you bottle it. So I am going to, I'm making that too. That's only a, like, you know, 2 quarts of it. With the, so anyway, today I decided I'm also going, I've made the decision I was going to make mead. So I asked Rand, I went over to Rand's house this morning, and he gave me a list of all the equipment I need, and the ingredients, and, which I'll go over with you. And, so then we went to the, him and Mark and I, Mark and Rand and I went to the, that's Mark is Rand's partner. We went to the beer and wine hobby store, and I bought the equipment. So the equipment is basically, you need 2 vessels. You need a, because you need to, there's 2 fermentation processes. There's the first fermentation, and then there's the second fermentation. And basically, with the first, so I was told is that if you want 3 gallons of wine, because I'm going to do like the 3-gallon version, is it's better to have a larger vessel for the first one, because you can always add a little extra water, because when you're racking it into the second container, you're not going to put everything in there, because all this crud is on the bottom. That's dead yeast cells and fruit and what have you. And basically you just want to have the fairly clear liquid, the mead, going into for the second fermentation. That one's okay with the 3-gallon, because you want to try to get as close to 3 gallons as possible. That's the important thing. And then when that settles, you will be able to, you know, bottle that then from that point. And that is where, you know, that's the second fermentation. Then you bottle it, and then you let it sit for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, or whatever. Apparently, it lasts a long time and gets better with age. So the recipe I'm using for mead, you can make mead in all sorts of varieties. And I mean by that is that you have a dry mead, a medium mead, and a sweet mead. I'm going to go with the medium mead, and that's about 1 quart of honey per gallon of final liquid. So it's like 1 quart of honey, 3 quarts of water. And I'm going to start off with and a quart is 3 pounds. So I'm going to have 9 pounds of honey and, the water. And I'm going to put some, I'm going to flavor it. Now, that's another thing you can do. You can do all sorts of things, adding fruit to it. A popular fruit to add to mead is oranges and raisins and stuff like that to help feed the yeast. So I'm going to use orange and lemon. I'm going to do half orange, half lemon with a handful of raisins. And then I'm also going to add nutmeg, which, of course, for longtime Filet Show listeners might know that this is my favorite spice because it was so prevalent in the 19th century cooking. Lemon, too. So I'm going to – that's going to be my first mead. So hopefully it will be good. I'm going to bottle them in smaller bottles, like 12-ounce bottles, beer bottles, which I'll get from the beer distributor when that time rolls around. The most important thing, it's very, very simple to do. The most important thing is you need to make sure that all the equipment is clean. And so Rand told, he uses an iodine solution, which I'm going to do. You scrub the glass and then you rinse it out with iodine, let it sit and empty that out and, rinse it out, and you're ready to add your stuff. And then it sits for about a month, 3 weeks to 3 to 4 weeks, until the yeast has stopped, you know, bubbling, basically, fermenting. And then you rack it into a second bottle, and then you cover it and let it sit for, I don't know for how long. I think you let it sit until it settles out and becomes clear, because it's quite cloudy until that point. You can test it at this point when you rack it over to the new system, the new bottle. And if it isn't sweet enough, you can add more honey to it. Now, of course, there's still yeast in there, so it's going to be making, you know, the yeast will become active again and start eating the honey and making more alcohol and CO2 fumes. But, you know, there you have it. There you have it, kids. What else was I going to say? So that's it, basically. So now I'm going to go take a look at my raisin wine, see what it's doing. Hold on. Going over to the raisin wine. And is it doing anything? I can see it sitting there on the shelf. I'm supposed to stir it once a day. So maybe I'll stir it now. Okay, I'm stirring it up. Looks like it's gas. I mean, it's making a, it's making gases, so, you know, hopefully it's good yeast. I'm gonna smell it here. It smells good. Shake it up a little bit. Put it back up here. So that's the raisin wine. I'm making that right now. On New Year's Day, that's when I'm going to make the mead. So that's it. Is there anything else? I mean, it's only 12 minutes. And I'm already done. That's it, really. Basically, it's going on, kids. It's New Year's. It's the end of the holidays. Starting rehearsal next Thursday for Caesar. Oh, the Castro. I wanted to talk about something from San Francisco, which I didn't talk about last week, and it completely. And I said, I thought to myself, okay, I'll talk about it next week, and I forgot it. Actually, I forget what it was. I don't know if I told you about Turk Street. I walked right through the middle of the Tenderloin, and I'll just repeat this: is that the Tenderloin is very. You know, I think I did mention this. It's very poor. I mean, there's a lot of drug addicts and stuff. And then you have, right across the street, you know, Neiman Marcus and Coach stores and stuff. So it's very odd. Something else about San Francisco is that, you know, when you think of San Francisco, it's the gay town, right? Well, because of all the high-tech companies that are there, like Google and stuff, all those gay houses are being... You know, the gays are moving out because they're being outpriced, I guess, in the Castro. So you have a lot of people with babies. There's this big thing going on, and they've passed the law is to ban nudity in San Francisco. Now, you might think, ban nudity, especially in the Northeast, with the prudes here. What do you mean, ban nudity? That should have been banned years ago. Well, in the San Francisco, it was not uncommon to see naked people walking down the street. You know, as long as you're not bothering anybody, it wasn't against the law. Well, the people in the Castro got these white, I'll say white, these high-tech people, the straight people, were upset at seeing, having naked people walk around. So they had their representative, who happens to be a gay man, you know, write this legislation to ban nudity in San Francisco. So it's, you know, the Castro's ungaying, okay? It's becoming ungay. San Francisco is changing. It's becoming more prudish, which is a shame. I think historically it's a live and let live town. But I think it's inevitable that this stuff happens. I mean, before the Castro was gay, right? There were Irish families in there, right? Working class Irish families. And, you know, they were sore. They were upset that when the gays were moving in. And now the straights are moving back. High-tech straights. So where will the gays go? Where, what will be the new San Francisco? You know, I could bemoan it and feel like I'm being threatened or whatever as a gay person. You know, our neighborhoods are being taken away, but we'll find new neighborhoods. You know, it's like, that's just the way it is. I mean, it happens with everybody. I mean, whether you're Jewish or black or whatever, or Italian, I mean, you know, it's like the Jewish neighborhoods in, for example, in Philadelphia or in North Philadelphia, and then they moved north, you know, to the suburbs, you know, and other people moved into the North Philadelphia. So, you know, these things happen. How long does a neighborhood last, you know? Well, in Boston, they sort of speed up the process by ripping down entire neighborhoods and building these awful concrete structures like City Hall. But, you know, do I call it progress? No, it's just change. And do I like it? No, because I like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, but, you know, like everything changes, so I can't really be too upset about it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm upset about it, but at the same time, I'm not losing any sleep over it because it's something that happens. I mean, listen, if I were wealthy, you know, well, then there would just be wealthy gays living in San Francisco, you know? It's like, what kind of fun is that? I mean, not that I think that wealthy people are boring, but, you know, sometimes they are, you know what I'm saying? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? But, you know, eventually, the good thing is, eventually, they're all going to lose their money and be in the poor farm. Happens to every family. So, because I once came, as I've talked about before, my grandfather's mother, she's French aristocracy. You know, she was French aristocracy. They were landowners, very wealthy, and lost the money during the revolution that happened in France in the late 19th century. Came to America, poor as church mice, went to the church for help. They said, no, we're not going to help you. And then she said, fuck you, and she became an atheist. And so my grandfather was raised an atheist. You know, good for him. You know, this is the beginning. He's born 1906. So, you know, and there's also the other side of my family. My grandmother's side, my mother's father. Actually, it's all my mother's side. I don't know about my father's side. They were probably all barkeeps. My grandmother's grandmother was a daughter to a man who had a chair on the New York Stock Exchange. They had tons of money. That part of the family never worked. They always had a trust fund. And by the time, I guess, I don't know what happened or when she died, she might have died after the crash, but the money was gone, basically, you know. But he was very wealthy, you know, and he was a teenager, and he didn't fight in the Civil War. He was a cook in the Civil War. He was involved with the Civil War doing something, and then he somehow made it big in business and had a chair in the New York Stock Exchange. I don't know the whole story, but I do know that. And I thought, oh, well, what's that mean? But apparently it's big meant something. So look it up. I was surprised. And I was like, what happens to money? You know, I was like, what happens to all this stuff, you know? I'm hoping, you know, one day I'll get a letter. Oh, Mr. Steffler, you're the inheritor of this estate in France. You're the dolphin of whatever. I'll be like, okay, when can I become king of France? Which would probably be a bad move on my part, considering the history of royalty in France. Let's just measure your neck here now for the guillotine. Yeah, so there you go. Kilt. Oh, yeah, I bought a new kilt in San Francisco. It's a really cool. It is a camo kilt. and I was wearing it, and it felt really good, you know, to wear. But it was kind of windy that day I bought it. And I'm walking down the street, and the thing's, like, flapping open. Of course, I wasn't nude. I mean, I didn't flash anybody, though I did wear it traditionally. And it was cool, right? But I was really warm wearing it, let me tell you. I got really, you know, moist, let's just say. And it's an amazing thing. I often wondered. I always thought, like, you know, women who wore skirts and stuff would be cold, but apparently it's really not, you know, if you wear it right. And the kilt, I was quite pleased with the warmth I was afforded. However, I was also very aware of wind blowing up and exposing myself, you know. And if it hadn't been for the law that just changed, I wouldn't have cared. But who wants to be arrested in San Francisco, you know? So when I came home, I bought a little pin, and I pinned the thing down so when I wear it, it doesn't flap, you know, which is a good thing. And I'm wearing it now. Ooh. I got upgraded my PA. I got a captive bead this time. Though I still pee like a lawn sprinkler, so I have to sit down. But, you know, I think it's a good, it's a good thing. It's a good trade-off, so. Well, on that note, on with the show, and Happy New Year's, everybody. Da 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 da. I know I'm a fool, but a fool has a rule, has a reason for being a fool. I've been a fool since I met you, a fool who wouldn't forget you. Every ache of the heart that you caused me, like a fool I was willing to bear. Because for a friend, I thought in the end you'd change and you'd try to be square. When they told me that you didn't love me, like a fool I still thought you were true. I should hate you right now, but I love you somehow. I'm a fool who believed in you. A fool, as a rule, never thinks he's a fool. But I'm one who don't follow the rule. I've been a fool and I know it. Every ache of the heart that you caused me, like a fool I was willing to bear. because for a friend, I thought in the end, you'd change and you'd try to be square. When they told me that you didn't love me, like a fool I still thought you were true. I should hate you right now, but I love you somehow. I'm a fool who believed in you. The Year by Ella Wheeler Wilcox. What can be said in New Year rhymes that's not been said a thousand times? The New Year's come, the old years go. We know we dream, we know. We rise up laughing with the light. We lie down weeping with the night. We hug the world until it stings. We curse it then and sigh for wings. We live, we love, we woo, we wed. We wreathe our brides, we sheet our dead. We laugh, we weep, we hope, we fear. And that's the burden of the year.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne? For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for auld lang syne. Take a cup of kindness yet for auld lang syne. We have ran about the brae and pulled the gowans fine. We've wandered many a weary foot since auld lang syne. For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for auld